Encourage you to open your Bibles to the book of Daniel, chapter 1. And we'll be looking at that passage in just a minute. I do have a special announcement that I want to make that I forgot about this morning. In the foyer, we have some copies of Focus Magazine, which is a special issue that has been printed for the purpose of those who are not Christians. Tim Jennings, David Holder, and several that I know personally have contributed to this magazine. They're very well-written articles. And we have purchased a couple of hundred copies. I don't have all of them out yet. To encourage you to take them and to put them into like a prominent public place, if they'll allow, a doctor's office, a hospital, or maybe a place at work, or just give it to a friend that you know who's not a Christian. Encourage them to read it. And I need, first of all, a couple of volunteers that would be willing to put the stamp on the back so that we'll have our church name and address on it and contact information. And then I need a bunch of volunteers to take advantage of this opportunity to use these very well-written articles and distribute them to friends and different people that you know who are not Christians. I want to read from the book of Daniel, chapter 1. And the first four verses, where it says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure of the house of his God. And then the king instructed Osmanoff, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men, in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans." It was a very tragic time for the nation of Judah, although it had been prophesied by Jeremiah. The coming of the Babylonian captivity, 605 B.C. was the time. When Nebuchadnezzar's armies moved south and they threatened Judah, and they took, as the text says, certain young men and carried them away captive. The purpose of this was, number one, to hold them hostage so that the captive might send some kind of tribute. And secondly, to educate and to instruct some of these young men in the ways of the Chaldeans so that they might be able then to return and to instruct their people in the ways of the Chaldeans. And among these men were four very well known in the context. One young man by the name of Daniel, and his three men, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, otherwise known as Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And there are three lessons that I want us to learn from the book of Daniel with regard to the remarkable conviction of these four men, Daniel and his three friends. That is, conviction at a young age, conviction at middle age, and conviction at old age. First of all, in Daniel chapter 1, we read this very familiar story where he says in verse 8, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself." He had purposed that he would not defile himself with the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Exactly what was intended by that, I'm not sure, and the text doesn't tell us. We can guess that perhaps Daniel was concerned about certain dietary laws that were found in the old law. It may be that he was trying to abstain from strong drink, or it may be that this wine was some kind of wine that was dedicated to the Babylonian gods. But nonetheless, Daniel at a very young age had made a determination that he was not going to defile himself. Now, exactly how young he was, we don't know. But we do know this, that the time frame would have been 605 B.C. We also know that when we go over to the sixth chapter, and we find the same Daniel is serving in the court of Darius the Mede, that the time frame would have been approximately 536 B.C. That is the time when the Persians finally conquered the Babylonians. So when you begin to do the math, you find that a span of 70 years has passed between Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 6. Also, we find in Daniel 6 that Daniel is at least young enough, relatively speaking, to still be serving as a civil servant in the courts of the Persians. So if Daniel is 90 in the 6th chapter, that means that he's 20 in chapter 1. If he's 85 in the 6th chapter, that means that he's 15 in chapter 1. The point is that Daniel at this time was a very young man. And it would have been very easy for him to have rationalized and said, well, you know, wait a minute, I've been taken away from home. It would have been really easy for him to have had the little pity party and said, you know, poor little me, you know, I've been taken away a captive. It would have been easy for him to rationalize because he was being educated in a heathen school, that is, in the schools of the Chaldeans or schools of the Babylonians. But instead, Daniel is a remarkable example at a very young age of strong conviction and purpose. Daniel has a remarkable understanding of the presence of God. In fact, there are two Bible characters that always impress me a great deal because of that. Joseph and Daniel always, even at a young age, have a remarkable understanding of the omniscience and presence of God, that God is always there. And so Daniel realized, even though he has been moved far away from home, he has not moved away from God. And therefore he made the determination, even though he is no longer at home, that he is still going to serve Jehovah God. And so he purposed that he would not defile himself. Well, in the 3rd chapter, we come to the familiar story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, otherwise known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Incidentally, all four of these men, their names have been changed to represent the heathen gods. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were God-honoring names that honored Jehovah. But the Babylonians changed their name to Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in honor of their false gods. Well, first of all, look in the 2nd chapter. And in the 2nd chapter, in verse 48, we find that during this time frame, that over a passing of time, that these men have been promoted. It says in verse 48 that the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. And he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king. He set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. First of all, we notice that the time has passed and that because of their integrity and because of their character, Daniel has been promoted. And by reason of petition, his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, have also been promoted to a higher position in the affairs of the Babylonian Empire. But the real story, of course, begins in the 3rd chapter. The real story begins in chapter 3 in verse 1 when it says that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, administrators, governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then a herald cried out, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in sympathy with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You get the scene. Therefore, these three men are going to be called upon to violate the first two of the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other God before me, and you shall not make any graven image. They have been called upon to bow before this false god that Nebuchadnezzar has set up at the sound of all the music. However, remarkably, we find that these three men, like Daniel, were men of conviction and devoted to serving Jehovah God. And thus the report goes out in verse 12. And in verse 12 it says, "There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up." They don't worship your God. Now the result of that is that King Nebuchadnezzar is, in the old saying, so mad he can't see straight. He's madder than a hornet. And in fact, in verse 13, it says that Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and fury, gave command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so they brought these men before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar then begins to threaten these three men in verse 14. He says to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in sympathy with all kinds of music, and worship the image which I have made good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will be able to deliver you from my hands? Don't you understand the situation? That if you refuse to bow before this God, I'm going to cast you into a burning fiery furnace, and there is no God that will be able to deliver you." Well, the answer is beginning in the 16th verse. Their answer is that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and He will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Now, consider the remarkable statement they have made. That no matter what God does, and we know indeed that Jehovah God has the ability to deliver us, but no matter what He does, whether He delivers us or no, we are not going to bow before your false God. This is an amazing conviction of three men at approximately the time frame we would call middle age. The fact is that peer pressure not only comes when you're a teenager, but it comes all through your life, even on the job, even in secular, and even in corporate America. Yet these three men, like Elijah before Baal, like Moses before Pharaoh, and like David before Goliath, they are going to stand on the side of Jehovah God. It would have been easy for them to excuse themselves, but instead they say, "Our sovereign is Jehovah. And we ought to obey God rather than men." Consider four possible excuses. First of all, number one, they might have said, "Well, you know, after all, Nebuchadnezzar is the one who gave us this promotion. He has given us this great opportunity. He has given us a free education in the school of the Babylonians. And He's given us this wonderful job. And in fact, not only that, but He has given us a promotion." But instead of rationalizing, they determined to stand on God's side. It would have been easy for them to say, "Well, you know, after all, everybody's doing it." Imagine going to Kyle Field on a Saturday afternoon in November And the announcer says, "Everybody bow before Reveille and worship the dog. Or otherwise, you're going to be killed." Imagine a stand of 85,000 fans and they all bow but three. I'm telling you, these three boys stuck out like a sore thumb. The whole multitude bows, but three men who have the courage to stand on God's side. It's easy for us to compromise with the world. The challenges are there. But when young men and women will say, "I'm not going to dress like the world, but I'm going to dress in a fashion that represents the holiness of God." When they say, "I'm not going to use the language of the world, but I'm going to use language that is on God's side." When they say, "I'm not going to do the deeds and actions of the world, but rather I'm going to stand on God's side because I'm a representative of Him," then I say high praise to those young people. The reality is that Paul says, "Yea, and all who who are godly will suffer persecution." 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, George's paraphrase. And the fact is that Jesus said in Matthew the 7th chapter that not many are going to go in the straight and narrow way. The fact is that God's people are always in a minority. But another fact is that God and one man makes a majority if you're on God's side. The third excuse they could have given is they could have said, "Wait a minute, you know, consider the severity of the situation. If we die, we'll no longer be able to serve God." But instead they say, "God's able to deliver us. But whether He delivers us or not, we want you to know we're not going to serve your false god." You see, there are a lot of people that are willing to serve God as long as things go well, but when difficulties arise, they quit. And the fact is that there are many people who want God to keep the deal that we made with Him. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. Thus, no matter what, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, "We're going to do what God wants." And thus they show remarkable courage and remarkable conviction. The sixth chapter of Daniel, we come to the time frame when Daniel is an old man. Perhaps 85, 90 years old. We don't know exactly how old, but we know 70 years have passed from chapter 1 to chapter 6. David would say in the Psalms, "I have been young and I've been old, and yet I've never seen the righteous forsaken, nor my children begging bread." Here's a man who is a remarkable example of that. The Babylonian Empire has been overthrown. In chapter 6, beginning with verse 1, the record says, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satrap might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satrap because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm." And what's really remarkable about that is that here we have a change of nation and a change of king, and yet Daniel is so well respected that he's even given opportunity to serve in the courts of this Persian king. Now we know that we're in an election year, and we know what happens when a new president comes into office. He'll bring in all his cronies, whatever the case may be, advisors, to serve in his office. And yet remarkably, even though there has been a change of nation and a change of empire, Daniel is even given an opportunity to serve in this Persian king, under this Persian ruler. Well, the result of that is jealousy. Because in verse 4 it says, "The governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him." That is also remarkable. They said, well, let us see if we can find some kind of skeleton in the closet. Maybe it's a girlfriend. Maybe it's extortion. Or some kind of act of deception or lack of integrity. But they could find nothing. Here's a man who has lived in the public eye for all of these years, and they can find no charge against him. If they've been following the presidential debate, then every time one candidate rises to the top, you find something about him that disappoints you. It just seems to be the nature of the game. But remarkably, here is a young man, or an old man now, who has lived in the public eye, and they can find nothing against him except one thing. Look at what it says in the fifth verse. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Okay, there we have a charge. Why, this fellow served Jehovah God, the God of the Jews. That's the charge we'll bring against him. It sort of reminds me of today. You know, when you become a Bible believer, then the charge is, well, here's this right-wing, radical, Bible-believing individual. Why, he believes that abortion is a sin. Why, they believe that adultery is a sin. Why, here's a person who respects it. It reminds me of an interview that was done several years ago with Ken Starr on ABC with Diane Sawyer. And the question was asked, which proved nothing, basically. The question was asked, is it true that when you were a boy, you really went to a church that believed that it was a sin to dance? That's a loaded question that proved nothing. Proved absolutely nothing with regard to the integrity or character of Ken Starr, who was, by the way, the prosecuting attorney who was hired to prosecute Bill Clinton. But here's the point. We can't find anything against Daniel except the fact that he worshiped Jehovah God. And so they devise a plan to destroy him. In verse 6, these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said to him, thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satrap, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius, sign the written decree." And so, the law goes forth. If you petition any god except the gods of the king, you'll be thrown in the lion den. And what's Daniel's reaction? Now, Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Nothing changes with Daniel. In fact, it would have been easy for him to say, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll just close the windows. I'll pray in private." But he keeps the windows open before all the people. And as had been his custom all along, he continues to offer his petition to Jehovah God. It has been said that conviction is belief inspired of hard circumstances. When you're really tested, the test is where what shows what you're really made of. Daniel is still going to do what's right no matter what. He's still going to serve Jehovah God no matter what. And he's still going to have that three times a day prayer, non-negotiable. Nobody's going to change it. I'm still going to have that time with Jehovah God, and I don't care what people think. Thus, we find in Daniel three remarkable stories of amazing conviction of a young man, of three men at middle age, and of Daniel when he is old, willing to pay the price. A marvelous and wonderful example for all the rest of us. Like a breath of fresh air in a world of wickedness, it is to see young men and women who take a stand on God's side, who determine to remain pure, and who refuse the ways of the world. To see middle-aged men refusing to compromise their integrity, a devoted housewife devoted to her home, an aged mother or an elderly man leading a prayer, or making a comment in a Bible class, or standing firm, even though they've not only been through the hills, but also the valleys of life. They're the best people on earth. They are remnant. They are God's people. Thus the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." If you're on God's side, nothing else matters, because that's all that matters. If you're here today and never become a Christian, that's an act of courage to tell the world that you want Jesus Christ to be the Lord of your life, that you're going to serve Him and no longer going to serve self, that you're willing to come to this act of submission, to be buried with Him in baptism and raised to walk a new life. If that be your need, or whatever the need you may have, if we can assist you in any way, we encourage you to come. Would you come as we stand and sing the song selected? All things are